I'm Bert Cohen, and with your help, we are keeping democracy alive.
Check for pulse. Stand clear. Push to shock.
America's fascists are those people who think Wall Street comes first and the American people come second.
What we've really seen is a financial sector that's gotten out of hand, has much too much of a role in this country.
What Putin is trying to do and what Trump is trying to do is undermine faith in our government.
An absolute typhoon of terror against African Americans.
There's a huge gap between public opinion and public policy that people don't feel that they can do very much.
I speak tonight for the dignity of man.
Another year, another Memorial Day. Of course, this one is somewhat different in that social gatherings, barbecues, and beers won't be the routine thing. It's supposed to be a day when Americans stop and think about those service people who have died, who sacrificed their lives for the greater good of America. All the flags, the red, white, and blue bunting, they'll all be there, no difference this year. Our guest, Eric Edstrom, is a veteran of the 18-year war in Afghanistan, and he has a new book out coinciding with Memorial Day titled Un-American, A Soldier's Reckoning of Our Longest War. It's put out by Bloomsbury. Eric Edstrom is a graduate of West Point and the University of Oxford, was an infantry officer, Army Ranger, and Bronze Star Medal recipient who deployed to direct combat in Afghanistan. Being myself a veteran of the early anti-war movement of the late 60s and early 70s, it's hard for me to share in his hope that maybe 2020, and this is a quote from him, maybe 2020 is the year when we finally look at ourselves in the mirror and admit it, that we really are a nation of 330 million bumper sticker patriots willing to sell out future generations to pay for endless war, end of quote. Yeah, I used to have more hope about that years ago. It's surprising how we haven't learned. Especially on Memorial Day, we slap a veteran on the back, shake his or her hand, and say thanks for his service. And we do mean it. But what about those who have been in our endless wars, who have actually seen friends' lives either ended or forever impacted by the fighting in Afghanistan? As humans, as patriotic Americans, what happens when they look back on their experiences and agonize over what it was all about? Why did it happen? All that death and destruction, what is it for? In Edstrom's book, he asks a basic question. Why is it so difficult for Americans to reckon with the reasons, costs, and impact of our wars? Seeing how so many lives are uprooted as Americans, do we get to question American militarism? What is patriotism, really? In isolation, this COVID-19 isolation, Edstrom has had the time to reconsider his own time fighting in Afghanistan and the military he left behind. He wonders if perhaps this Memorial Day 2020, quote, the COVID-19 pandemic causes us to redefine what patriotism and national security really mean. Thanks for being with us, Eric Edstrom. Thanks so much.
Hey, Bert, it's great to be here. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, in 1990, Vietnam veteran Tim O'Brien published Things They Carried, about a platoon of American soldiers fighting on the ground in the Vietnam War. Your article, celebrated to death, Memorial Day is Killing Us, on Tom Dispatch, a great read if anybody wants, starts off describing something you carried into the Afghanistan War when you visited there in 2009. You intended journaling to be a distraction, but you write that soon, quote, that journal acquired a more macabre tone. What do you mean? Please explain.
Yeah. I was 23 years old and I was a relatively freshly minted infantry lieutenant. I had graduated from West Point, went to Ranger School and Reconnaissance School, and was put in charge of my first platoon. And I was out there in Fort Carson, Colorado with 4th Infantry Division, and we were gearing up to go to Kandahar Province, and we knew it was going to be a tough year. And in advance of that, you sort of think, well, what do I really need? What do I want with me when I'm there for a year? And, you know, some people pick up different hobbies. You have a certain allotment of space in the shipping container for your unit for, you know, extra stuff. You know, some folks ship over their favorite guitar or their banjo or playing cards or, paints or, you know, like tattoo equipment, all sorts of different stuff, you know, ends up in those sort of shipping containers.
Boy.
And for me, you know, I was thinking it's probably a good idea to have something to write with, something that, you know, I can take an appraisal of this experience. And so I just bought a really basic journal, you know, this sort of thing you'd find at, you know, an Office Max, and said, okay, this is going to be my journal. It's going to follow me around for this year. And, you know, in the article, the quote that you're mentioning was that very quickly that journal sort of had some gravitas to it. It was, you know, you first talk about the flight over, you know, the sort of surreal notion that you're going to go to war. You're in 1 year's time, you will be a year older and you will probably have seen some things that were pretty troubling, but you may also be dead. You might be horrifically injured, and there's a lot of uncertainty placed on the next year, and you sort of write about it. You end up getting to Kyrgyzstan, and then you finally make it to Kandahar airfield, and then eventually out to your smaller FOB. And when I got out to FOB Wilson, it was only about 4 patrolling days until we started getting casualties. Uh-huh. And the macabre tone that you're mentioning is that sort of on that 4th day of patrols, one of my squad leader's vehicles was driving off-road in the dirt, and we were doing sort of another humdrum route clearance patrol mission, and their vehicle hit an IED.
Mm-hmm.
And the vehicle was catastrophically destroyed. You know, truck tires and the engine block sheared off. And, you know, very quickly, it became exceptionally real that I was going to evacuate wounded, bloody soldiers of mine who I had only just become friends with and, you know, became close with in the previous sort of 6 months leading up to deployment.
This guy who was wounded by this improvised explosive device, what do you think his experience with death over there had anything to do with what became of him when he returned to America? And you said he was going to be okay. What were your thoughts as you said that to him, and what became of him? How do you think the experience affected him?
It wasn't just one guy. It was the whole truck. Everyone was injured in that truck.
Hmm.
There were 4 soldiers in that truck, and they had various injuries. You know, and you're not entirely certain when you open up the back of that truck and there's, you know, pieces of vehicle everywhere.
Mm.
And you have that sort of heart palpitation moment when you do a radio call to their vehicle after they've been blown up, seeing if anyone is capable of responding to your call. And no one is. And you call again, and you call again, and no one responds. And the only thing that you can think is, oh, we need to get out and see if we can treat these guys. And we have no idea what's going to be on the inside of that truck. And, yeah, I mean, some of them were in various forms of, consciousness basically. And, you know, broken limbs, lacerations on their face and body from smashing around on the inside of the vehicle. The soldier that you're referring to is, a guy by the name of AJ Nelson, who was one of the privates in my platoon. And he was the gunner in this vehicle at the time. And, you know, he's shot up by our doc with morphine or ketamine, and, you know, blood is coming over the cracked corners of his lips, and he's there. And but, you know, you go around kneeling down with each of your soldiers. You've done all the work you can do. You've called in the air medevac helicopter to pick these guys up. There's nothing else you can really do other than just be there with them and wait for the 15 minutes until the helicopter shows up. And in a more philosophical and deeper way, not that I was thinking that way in this moment, but when people reassure their soldiers that they're going to be okay, you say, what do you mean? Well, is that going to be a double amputation, but you're alive? Does that mean you're okay? Or is it, oh, you only had a traumatic brain injury, that you're okay? So, you know, what is okay? What is the definition of okay in this world?
And
it's heavy stuff.
You were 23 at the time, 24, something like that? Yikes.
Yeah, I was 23 and then turned 24 during deployment while we were there for a year.
You write, although I was told I'd be fighting terrorism in Afghanistan, most of the people our unit was killing turned out to be teenagers or angry farmers with legitimate grievances. What were those grievances, and what about them had you thinking, had I been in their shoes, I would have done the same?
Mm.
That must have been challenging to think about.
When you are trained to go to war, you are trained to believe that the people who you are fighting and who are fighting and resisting you are the enemy. And the enemy is, by default, evil in some way. And they have to be killable. Because if they're not killable, how can you kill people that don't deserve it? And there's sort of this sense that once you're actually there and you sort of look under the hood, that there's a lot of stuff that's going on, that if you just switched it around and merely said, you know, imagine myself in their shoes, imagine if the birth lottery allocated me to grow up in Afghanistan instead of the United States, what would I think about an 18-year occupation of my country? Or alternatively, you know, I'm in Boston right now. You know, imagine if some foreign country for, you know, benevolent terms decided that they were going to, you know, occupy Boston and aim guns at us, occasionally shoot us because our vehicles were getting too close to them and they thought it was, quote, a threat. You know, that they would accidentally bomb our weddings because there's a gathering of people and they thought it was the Taliban, but it wasn't. And these are all recorded incidents. You know, there's been a dozen or so wedding bombings, you know, rendition, you know, black sites for torture. And then I sort of saw the more banal but equally cruel just devaluation of their lives on a day-to-day basis. And the excusal of culpability by the military, where whenever, you know, the military shoots somebody, you know, they just write it off and say it's a threat. And, you know, the 19-year-old soldier on the machine gun felt that he or she was being threatened and that was in accordance with the rules of engagement. And that's incredibly troublesome.
Yeah, I'm sure. I am significantly older than you are. I don't know if that's good or bad. Whatever, it's the truth. Vietnam was raging when I was young. And after being told we were there fighting communist aggression, I eventually learned that the Vietnamese had liberated themselves through a war of independence from colonial France. And I also found myself thinking, geez, if I were in their shoes, maybe I would have done the same. And I thought, for sure, our military leaders would learn the obvious lesson. Without real popular support, you know, if we're seen as the invaders, you just can't have any sort of victory. It amazes me how we have refused to learn that fairly simple lesson. Your reflections on that?
Well, if you want to take a very clinical view of this, and you want to just approach this from a logical perspective, well, what are the ways that you can stop an insurgency?
Right.
You know, how can you do it?
Yep.
And you can say, okay, well, you can, quote, you know, remove the enemy from the battlefield, which is a euphemism for killing people.
Right.
And kill the insurgency out. And so that you can say, hey, these are current insurgents. We identify them and they are killed. Irrespective of the morality around that, but let's just assume that their
tactically
morality doesn't matter.
Sure.
So you can remove them from the battlefield and kill these people, or you can get insurgents to lay down their weapons and stop fighting at a rate that outpaces the number of new insurgents that pick up arms. So you basically you have to have a net reduction in insurgents,
sure. Yeah.
You know, if that is what beating an insurgency is a net reduction in insurgency, it's either accomplished through killing people or, through hearts and minds where people decide, hey, you're not so bad. We're not going to fight you. We want the same things and we're going to cooperate instead of fight. And there's compelling reasons to not pick up arms. Well, in Afghanistan, and I'm sure, although I never had firsthand experience in Vietnam, if you take a view of it and you say, even Stanley McChrystal's famous sort of McChrystal math, as it was described, where for every civilian you kill, you make 10 new insurgents, right. People that are justifiably angry.
Yes.
So what that means is that if you're going to proceed with this net reduction in insurgents, you need to be more precise and kill in such a way that you do not create more insurgents. So you have to do better than 1 to 10. And that is not the case in Afghanistan. There's a lot of civilian death, and you create a positive reinforcing cycle where, a soldier records a false positive and believes someone is a threat when they're not, and it's a civilian, and they kill the civilian, and then you have more insurgents.
Of course.
And then you have more fear, and then you have whatever it is, suicide bombers, which make people more defensive and register more false positives, which kills more civilians, which creates more insurgents, which creates more fear, more false positives, and you just have a recursive loop. It doesn't end.
Doesn't end. If you may have just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is called Keeping Democracy Alive, and special Memorial Day show. We're speaking with Eric Edstrom, veteran of the war in Afghanistan, who was an infantry officer, an Army Ranger, and Bronze Star Medal recipient, who was in direct combat in Afghanistan. We're talking about his new book, Time to Come Out with Memorial Day. The title of the book is Un-American, A Soldier's Reckoning of Our Longest War. Alfred Lord Tennyson's quote from the famous Charge of the Light Brigade was, "Ours is not to reason why, ours but to do and die." You write that a popular military aphorism was, "Stay in your lane." How does soldiers take this in? How does this directive affect something like a private journal?
So, stay in your lane, which I mentioned, is sort of about don't question things outside of your realm and focus on the task at hand rather than some of the perhaps strategic questions, which are, as it is, implied explicitly, you as an officer should not be thinking about. That's a thing that politicians should be thinking about. Your job is to execute, and therefore you shouldn't have any individual thoughts about the matters of morality or the war in which you are participating in.
Mm.
And I mean, that's a pretty ludicrous sort of thing. There's also, on that topic, right? I mean, it's my belief that war or the military and service in the military is not an absolute good. And what I mean by that is that it is only as good as the conflicts that you're being used to participate in. And it is fundamentally a very different career and profession than other forms of public service, such as being a firefighter or being a teacher, which focus on development, not destruction. So, if you become better at being a firefighter and you are better at putting out fires, presumably the community is better off. And you can probably sleep soundly thinking, hey, I'm getting better at my job. This is a good thing.
Mm.
If you are a teacher and you're better at educating children and teaching them about math and science and the arts and humanities and whatever else, again, you should probably sleep fairly soundly that, you're doing a good job. The same cannot necessarily be said about becoming better at shooting and occupying people in a different country. It does not necessarily make the world better off. It is not an absolute good. And you have to think long and hard about that topic, which is not encouraged.
Boy, that's quite a perspective. That's a very good and useful perspective. I wish more people would have that. But you're in a place where you got a different perspective. And anyone who either has been in a war or just, you know, read about them knows that a large percentage of time, at least my impression is that a large percentage of your time is just watching and waiting. The goal that where you were in Afghanistan was to stop the IEDs, the roadside bombs. In what ways was your work securing a road in Kandahar, as you call it, a self-licking ice cream? And an example of that was recalled in your journal, Halloween 2009. Tell us about that, please.
Yeah, so the topic about sort of the self-licking ice cream cone is a term I think originally used by NASA, which describes a system that only exists to sustain itself. And in the case of IEDs, we had this example where the me as the infantry platoon leader and my soldiers, my platoon, would risk our lives to drive up and down some of the most bombed out roads in Afghanistan just before the surge, when we sort of regularly recorded in the newspapers, you know, this is, quote, the bloodiest month in the Afghan war. And we set that record a couple times until, of course, it was eclipsed after the surge when more soldiers were there. But you drive up and down these roads, and because it was so bombed out, you couldn't actually proceed with any other sort of patrols. I won't even call them missions, because mission sounds like it has like a purpose that was thought of in advance and advances some other sort of objective. We didn't really do missions. It was more sort of like random activities. But, you know, you would patrol these roads so that you would be able to get resupplied, because the logistics convoys were terrified of driving down these roads to give you food, petrol, you know, all of this stuff. So, and they were getting blown up, and they were also not pure combat soldiers trained for a long time in fighting. So, you know, basically it got so bad that all we could do was patrol the roads. So it would be this thing where the infantry soldiers patrol the roads so that they can get resupplied, so that they have what they need, so that they can continue to patrol the roads so that they can get resupplied. And you continue this cycle ad nauseum in perpetuity throughout the year, not making any inroads into anything that one could consider progress, while simultaneously wasting billions and billions and billions of dollars and soldiers being injured in the process. Because the truth about IEDs, much like the Abraham Lincoln quote about, you can sort of, you can fool some of the people some of the time, or all the people some of the, that one.
Right.
But you can patrol some of the roads all of the time, or all of the roads some of the time, but never all of the roads all of the time. And wherever you were not patrolling, wherever you did not have overwatch, is where the insurgents would then stick in the next IED that would blow you up.
Right. So what happened on Halloween 2009?
So that was part of this recursive loop, which the soldiers had coined with the term Operation Highway Babysitter. And that was sort of an apt name, because that's exactly sort of what this was. And, you know, we were driving up and down this sort of 5-kilometer strip of road, you know, for 15 hours. You'd wear... I don't even know how much my kit weighed. I mean, I had imagined sort of 30 pounds between helmet, Kevlar, water, assault rifle, all of your extra ammunition, all that stuff. And you sit in this cramped vehicle and drive up and down for 15 hours a day, every single day. And then, you know, we're sitting on the side of the road overwatching some junction for, you know, 30 minutes or something like that. And we hear a bit of gunfire. And we turn our vehicles around and we head over in that direction. And when we get to this grape field, which, you know, the best analog for you to envision in your mind is a large wine vineyard. So think of that sort of, it's quite thick, and that sort of hedges are high. And, you know, we dismount from our trucks because we see a few guys in this field, and this is sort of where the shots were coming from, or so it sounded. Mm-hmm. We weren't 100% sure. Mm-hmm. And intelligence is always so dodgy that you never really actually know. So, you know, mm-hmm. we get out basically and say, well, they don't seem to have any weapons with them. Let's at least dismount. We'll set up the vehicles in sort of a defensive posture, and we'll go into the field, and I'll bring my interpreter, and we'll go ask him some questions. And we made it maybe about like 6-7 steps before they picked up weapons and started shooting through the vines at us. And then we sort of hunkered down behind whatever sort of crumbly bits of mud wall or in between the sort of the rows. It was extremely difficult to see, you know, but they were close. And, you know, one of my squad leaders throws a hand grenade. We're shooting back in sort of the best general direction that we can think of that they're firing at us from. And I call in some close air support from a set of Kiowa helicopters. Mm-hmm. And eventually they come on station and resistance fighters break contact and they run back further in the field. We don't really know where they are, but like we're unbelievably thankful. I look at my guys, none of them are bleeding or wounded. And we just feel very fortunate that, none of us got hurt in that ambush. And, you know, you basically have to leave it up to the Kiowas at that point because I don't have the perspective. So they come in and they fly over the top and they say, you know, can you identify where the insurgents are coming from? And I, you know, we can't. I talk them on and we fire a smoke grenade out into the field of roughly where we were last getting shot at from. And that's the best we can do. And I explain that articulately to them on the radio. And they say, okay, roger that. And then they start doing gun runs on a nearby set of mud buildings, basically a village. And, you know, we assume as the soldiers in the field that they've identified where the insurgents had run off to and were shooting at us from further away in the great field near this village. And that they were, you know, shooting them with 2.75-inch rockets and 50 caliber machine guns. And we're all cheering. And, you know, we're very thankful that we've lived this out and that, you know, there's a great relief that mm-hmm. the force of the American military has shown up as a cavalry to kill these guys that ambushed us. And, you know, we finally pack up our stuff after this calms down. Again, sort of terrified about anti-personnel mines that are set up. It's usually not a good idea to wander down some of these dirt paths into their territory because that's asking to get blown up. So we get back in the vehicles and continue on with our mission. And at the end of the day, I return back to the base and I see my platoon sergeant. And I had given him the day off because we were getting run absolutely ragged from these 15-hour missions. And I, you know, said, hey, you know, did you hear about the ambush? And he said, yeah. I got called into the battalion talk, or the tactical operations center, as it's called. And while we were in contact with these insurgents, not only was there the Kiowas observing what was happening, but also it was being recorded. And it was being recorded by a unarmed drone called Scan Eagle. So the drone flew over the grape field and had on camera recorded the firefight. And he said they could watch from the tactical operations center as if it were a video game, you know, us in the field and the, you know, insurgents disappearing. And then the Kiowa helicopters shooting up these mud mm-hmm. shacks. Mm-hmm. And they said that the drone was able to zoom in and see, you know, a dead woman covered in blood in a blue burqa. And there were no insurgents to be found, only civilian deaths. And then I return back, you know, and I'm at the main base with my platoon sergeant. And, you know, I start swearing expletives. And I'm like, they didn't have positive identification on anything. They just went on these gun runs. And that was shocking to me. And when I went into my own sort of company headquarters to see what the reports looked like, what the U.S. military had done was file those deaths as unknown. So they did not qualify or count them as civilian deaths. They counted them as unknown so that they wouldn't have to answer for it. And it got the Kiowa pilots off the hook.
Oh.
When I brought this up to my battalion commander and said that this is deeply embarrassing and something needs to be done for an investigation, he sort of said, oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. I appreciate your concern and thank you so much.
Mm-hmm.
And then nothing was done.
Boy, I remember during the Vietnam War, there was this body count we used to get all the time. And who knew, you know, what it's like anybody that was killed was listed as an enemy combatant. And that's just the way it went. If you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. We're speaking with Eric Edstrom. Memorial Day book, Un-American, A Soldier's Reckoning of Our Longest War. He was there in Afghanistan. We're talking about that. And what we may learn this year in 2020. You say that thudding backslaps and free beers from well-meaning civilians numbed my sense of betrayal. But over time, I realized that all of this thank you for your service stuff was just a culturally ingrained reflex, like saying bless you to someone who sneezes. When it comes to our military, the mantra of the public is thank, don't think. And you also say soldiers know the slaughterhouse. America knows chicken nuggets. That's quite a statement. What does that mean, Eric?
There's a couple things to unpack there. On the first bit that you were mentioning about the backslaps it is a trained reaction, I think. And I've had a diverse set of experiences where I've lived abroad for over 7 years in both the UK and Australia, and they certainly do not interact and have the same perverse relationship with their respective militaries as we do with ours. It does not lend itself to this fetishizing of the U.S. military. In Australia, it being in the military is a job. It's like other jobs. Great. I'm glad. I'm glad you're doing it. There isn't, you know, military discounts and, this obsession almost, with unquestioning obsession about the military. And what I'm trying to get at with that first statement is that the most intimate betrayal is to be sent to kill or die for nothing by your own countrymen. That is the most intimate betrayal. And to be sent off somewhere and your country doesn't even think about it.
Right.
And that is precisely what the American public has been doing for 18 odd years. And, you know, a different version of patriotism is having the courage and conviction to question what the military is being used for, because otherwise you're taking and misusing soldiers' service. And if I've learned anything from my personal experience, that service comes with quite a cost. And it's very cheap to put a few crinkled bills in a coffee can for Memorial Day. It's very cheap to say thank you for your service. That doesn't mean anything in the grand sense of protecting soldier service. It only sort of just perpetuates and continues the existing war, which everyone knows is both wildly expensive, self-perpetuating, and self-defeating. We've seen the Afghanistan papers. People have been saying it for decades. There's no amount of additional blood or treasure that can be dumped into this country to create some great victory for the American public. It's not making Americans safer at home.
Right.
And if we've learned anything from COVID, it is that America has pulled the metaphorical goalie in a hockey analogy and taken it. And instead of spending on national resilience or something like that, it has spent $1 trillion on low-value wars that don't add anything. And that is a huge problem. But back to, sorry, I went off topic a bit, Bert.
That's good.
where, redirect me. Where do I need to go?
I can't direct you, I'll tell you. So you say soldiers know the slaughterhouse. America knows chicken nuggets. Yes.
That's right. Yeah. That's
a good analogy.
That there's something about commoditizing and sanitizing war in the United States. That what, you know, people don't think and look behind the curtain when they, you know, talk about sending soldiers off to war, clapping for them when they're surrounded by pyrotechnics at the 50-yard line of, you know, the Veterans Appreciation Bowl or something like that. No thought goes into it. It's just, oh, look at this nice item. You know, the soldiers are a prop for the American public to feel good about their own patriotism. Wow. And it's almost like it's for their benefit, not ours. Because what would be beneficial for soldiers is to not have their service misused. And, you know, in a very Upton Sinclair, you know, jungle sense of abattoirs and killing of animals, the same sort of thing, I think, applies to war, where these people are being sent to conflict and seeing the real ramifications of death, and what Americans get back home is this processed, lifeless thing sold for cheap, and whatever it cost in blood was worth it.
Yeah, it helps at all these football games and sports things. It didn't used to be like that, but certainly in direct reaction, you know, to every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. You know, there was the picture that during the Vietnam War that America, you know, wasn't as good to veterans as it could have been. And I'm sure that's true. Because it wasn't you guys, the people in the field didn't make the policy. It was the policymakers who made the policy. But so at the football games, you know, there's this wonderful show and you guys are used as props. And that's it's disturbing to me, I have to say.
Yeah.
You know, it didn't.
And I'm not advocating being wicked to soldiers. That is not the takeaway, you know, of what it means to take the military off the pedestal. It is not to swing the pendulum the other way.
For sure.
And, you know, spit on soldiers like the Vietnam War. But it is about deep questioning and deep thought and conversation about what they're being used for.
Yes.
And we need to bifurcate and separate this absolute absurd fallacy that by questioning the value of the conflict soldiers are being sent to, that you are somehow, by association, condemning the soldiers who participate in it. And these are two separate things.
Totally. Yes. Absolutely. The policymakers are different entirely. And, you know, we just have to get to the policy. And you write, which brings up what's real and what's not. You write that in places like the Jari district in Afghanistan, it was now clear to me that the prevailing truth was whatever the U.S. military wanted it to be. End of quote. Nowadays, the concept of truth itself is disputed. In 2020, America, we're told, oh, it's fake news. Social media does post many things that are not true. How does this interact with the values you carried with you to Afghanistan? And how does it feel, this Memorial Day, truth, as opposed to, you know, what we're told is truth?
Oh, that's a complex one, Bert.
Oh, you can handle it.
I think from the deployment context, and as I mentioned in the story about Halloween, there's more to it, and there is a more nuanced discussion to be had about the realities of what is happening during the war on terror. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there could be tens of thousands of soldiers doing, you know, thousands of different patrols all over the country in any given day. And there are not thousands of reporters embedded with every single platoon. And ultimately, the military doesn't want to put itself in a place that's embarrassing. You know, when there is an option, when no one is looking, and when there is a disconnect between the individual morality of sort of the soldiers, or the officers, I guess, probably more like it, and the desires of the state, they come into conflict. And truth and honesty and all those nice things that you were taught about Army values are conditional. And, you know, it's important that if something is deeply embarrassing, it usually doesn't get said or told to the public. And that these things get tamped down. And that was what was clear from my personal experiences. So that is definitely disturbing. And the American public is not getting the full story because what they hear is a report that says, you know, 19-year-old Johnny was doing the right thing and shot up this school bus. well, it wouldn't be a school bus, but passenger bus, as it was the case with the Arkansas National Guard when I was there. And an Arkansas National Guardsman machine gunned a passenger bus. Mm. And I read the reports when I was doing my research for the book. And I patrolled that road all the time. And I saw these passenger buses all the time. They would never be a threat to soldiers. They drove around the convoys because we were, you know, doing route clearance and driving at 5 miles an hour. And they would drive around us in a very large arc to get back on the road and go about their business. And when this bus was driving around in an arc, as it was reported in this document, the Arkansas National Guardsman tried to wave at the bus and tell them to stop, and it didn't. It continued to drive around in the dirt. And whatever flailing arm signals, this 19-year-old didn't register with this Afghan truck driver, and he machine-gunned the cabin of the bus. You know, of course, if you did think it was a real threat to you or your convoy, you would actually want to do something that might actually stop the bus's further encroachment by shooting out the engine block or shooting out the tires or shooting just the driver. But no, he shot out the entire cabin, the passenger cabin where civilians are sitting. And when you read the reports, it's lies. They'll just say, you know, that it was justifiable and that he, you know, used the rules of engagement and that was perfectly fine.
Well, that's one thing clearly we did learn from Vietnam was don't allow cameras in, don't allow reporters in. There were reporters everywhere in Vietnam, and the people back home could see what was really going on. So that doesn't happen now. That's one thing that they learned, so to keep the truth from people. So here it is, another Memorial Day. You write, quote, "We've had a series of wars that everyone knows to be costly and self-defeating, while simultaneously maintaining the audacious idea that in doing so, they support the troops." And you add that soldiers and veterans don't need priority boarding, 10% discounts at gimmicky chain restaurants, or a few, as you said earlier, crinkle bills stuffed into a charity's coffee can. What do soldiers and veterans truly need, Eric? What do you think? I mean, you've been to it.
They need an American public that's engaged in what they're doing. They need an American public and a set of politicians that do not misuse their service by sending them to these self-perpetuating, self-defeating wars. And they need a country that values development above violence, political violence and destruction. And America is oriented as a political violence country. We spend so much money on solving the wrong problems the wrong ways. And it's not just for the American soldiers. The message needs to get out to the American people that if we do not question the trillions of dollars that we are spending on the military, we're hurting ourselves. We have an opportunity to do far bigger things. You know, here's an important thing that I try to hit home because I've studied climate change in graduate school, but every dollar that is invested in these self-perpetuating wars is not only a dollar not spent on abating the worst effects of climate change, but it is rather a reinvestment in future and worse wars caused by climate change because we did nothing about it. And those wars are going to be far larger, far more pervasive, and it is going to make the war on terror look like child's play when you have millions of people that will be internally displaced from their country because of flooding or crop shortages, water scarcity. Like, the notion that we're going to play Taliban whack-a-mole for $6.4 trillion and completely ignore the climate crisis should be wildly upsetting to every man, woman, and child in America. And we just don't even listen because it's background noise. The war on terror is elevator music to Americans, and we don't even notice that it's happening because such a small percentage of the American public actually is dying in these wars, but we are spending a ton of money in them. So yes, we are better about saving lives and double and triple amputees are surviving. Right. And one of my friends who is, you know, entirely lit on fire when his up armored Humvee was hit by an IED, and you know, he's gone through a bajillion facial reconstruction surgeries and everything else. And who knows what would have happened 50 years ago with those sorts of traumas.
Oh, for sure.
But these people, you know, we're better at keeping people alive and fewer people are dying. But to give you a sense of things, the $6.4 trillion, here's what you could do. You could wipe out all student debt, which is about $1.1 trillion. Credit card debt. It's about $1.5 trillion, I think, for student debt, $1.1 trillion for all credit card debt in the United States. You could take $10,000 bricks of $100 bills and go around the entire circumference of the world and still have enough left over to have a private Beyonce concert every single day for the next 3,600 years. That is what the war on terror cost.
And, you know, we just don't think about that. You know, people think about how much money, you know, unemployed people are getting. But they don't. It's the power of the military contractors, the weapons contractors. That's not the veterans. That's not the guys who are out in the field. That's military contractors who, you know, it's like chicken McNuggets there. You know, just they're making money and they don't get to see it. Amazing. And I know, you know, I've read a bit about other wars, like the war against Southern Secession, when the first Battle of Manassas, I believe it was, when the public thought, oh, goody, this will be fun. They went out and had a picnic to watch it. And then they were upset because people actually got killed. It was very bloody and very messy. And I recently, in my COVID-19 time, been reading a lot of books. And one of them was a wonderful book, E.L. Doctorow's The March, about General Sherman's now infamous March to the Sea, where total devastation ensued. And he's a great writer, E.L. Doctorow. He says, as Grant is nearing victory, he says, why is Grant so solemn today upon our great achievement, nearing victory? Except he knows that this unmeaning, inhuman planet will need our warring imprint to give it value, and that our civil war, the devastating manufacture of the bones of our sons, is but a war after a war before a war. That just knocked my socks off. It just goes on and on and on. So innocent civilians were killed. It goes on that, you know, they're counted as enemy. And another war that I've been intrigued by the folly that was the First World War. Last September, I happened to go with a group to many of the battle sites on the Western Front of the First World War. The random berms and trenches, barbed wire rusting in the wood. What really got me was these huge monuments. They were not merely monuments to the millions dead, but what they were there was to entice the boys of today and tomorrow with the prospect of glory. They had glory carved into these huge monuments, the word glory. Memorial Day is a time to feel a sense of patriotism. And of the Afghan War and so many others, you say, the most intimate betrayal, as you said earlier, is to be sent to kill or die for nothing by your countrymen. What about Americans not thinking they have a right to question the military or military spending? As you say, the act of doing so is taboo. Which brings us to the final question, really. What With your valuable perspective, how would you redefine patriotism and what national security really means? And, you know, you talked about how we can honor veterans. What is patriotism really? Because we all want, I mean, I feel patriotic. I've loved America, and you do too, obviously. But how can we, what's a good way to redefine patriotism and national security?
Yeah, two important and good questions. I think that wanting a better America should not be seen as a bad thing. To call out things that are broken and then using objective evidence to support that assertion should not be condemned as unpatriotic. It should be, you know, put on a pedestal as strategic thinking and something else. And I think that that's wildly problematic. It is questioning those sorts of taboos. In the beginning of my book, Un-American, I start out with a quote. And I think that this sort of captures my sentiment. And I came across this quote when I was doing research. And it just hit me. And I was like, yep, that's it. So let me read this to you.
Sure. Thank you.
Quote, "The difference between patriotism and nationalism is that the patriot is proud of his country for what it does, and the nationalist is proud of his country no matter what it does. The first attitude creates a feeling of responsibility, but the second, a feeling of blind arrogance that leads to war." Sidney J. Harris. So I think that you don't want to give unconditional support. You want to give conditional support on doing the right thing. Otherwise, you are supporting something which is not helping veterans. It's not helping the American people. It certainly didn't help the over 100 9/11s worth of dead civilians from the war on terror. And we lost an opportunity to spend $6.4 trillion or, you know, another $1.5 trillion spent on the F-35 fighter jet on far more important spending priorities with a far higher return on investment that doesn't kill anyone. And we missed that chance. But, you know, I also want to say that there's a story of hope and empowerment in there, which is that our country is perfectly organized to give us our current results. And if you do not like those results, if you do not like 18 years of endless war, if you do not like the highest incarceration rates of, you know, developed countries, if you do not like dithering on climate change, if you do not like, you know, a huge portion of our country that doesn't have adequate health care, well, then you need to change the forces that guide our nation.
It is difficult to do that. A lot of people give up too easily, in my opinion. You know, it takes, history doesn't turn on a dime. We've been dealing with these issues for a long time. And it takes a lot of persistence. And as my dad used to say, stick-to-itiveness. We have to do that.
Yeah. And I mean, as far as the second branch of that question about what do you describe? What is national security? If we define national security as the intent to reduce harm to Americans,
yes,
well, then we're missing the picture. Because if we're only doing that through the military and through intelligence services and data collection, if that's what national security is and what it really has become, and if you look at spending, that's true. We've missed the point that reducing harm to ordinary Americans is far more mundane than sexy equipment for political violence. That security and reducing harm for Americans is not national security as a offensive tool to protect against other humans that want to do us harm. It is about a national resilience in our own country as well. And whatever the proportion split is between the sort of, you know, we call it the defense budget and whatever else, but really it's the offense budget because, you know, at least for all of the time I was at West Point as an officer, I never did a single training exercise that was how to defend Baltimore or how to defend D.C. or Boston. It was always here you are in Iraq-Afghanistan hybrid city. It was never actually about defense. It was only about offense. But national resiliency and national security needs to take on a much broader sense. And I'll leave you with this, that, sure, you know, to something that should inflame people's, political thoughts about this topic is in 2013, for instance, the U.S. military realized that it was so expensive to ship back all these armored vehicles to the United States that rather than ship them back, they just decided to destroy them. So they destroyed $7 billion of military equipment in Afghanistan because they just, well, what are we going to do with this? So that's $7 billion that they just destroyed. That is more than the CDC's budget.
Oh, God.
The CDC's budget is like $6.5 billion or something like that. It's shocking to think that we have enough money to destroy these armored vehicles and not enough for the CDC. Or another comparison is, the base budget of the military, which is not the entire sort of military-industrial complex budget, but the base budget is over 100 times more than the CDC. And if we went back a couple of months, I think a few people in America might think maybe this proportion's a bit off.
Yeah, I would think so, too. Real national security, real patriotism. On this Memorial Day, thank you so much, Eric Edstrom. The book is titled Un-American, A Soldier's Reckoning of Our Longest War, just out published by Bloomsbury. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thanks, Bert.
Well, we've all been dehumanized, a generation of the same old lies. Security is an alibi. We lose the day in the cycle of life. Of your fellow man, going round the circles in the desert sands. We lose the loved ones protecting us. It's just another day on this Memorial Day. The hippies and the poets and the Spartans say, forget the reasons why we war. It's just the season we've been waiting for. Rich man's war, but the poor will pay. Sense or logic never comes to mind. Innocence is lost and guilt will fade in time. You turn around to face your death. You wish your mother could be there to share your last breath. Another good one has gone down, and we mourn the loss on this Memorial Day. The hippies and the poets and the Spartans say, forget the reasons, that's why we war. This is the season we've been waiting for. Man's war, but the poor will pay. Sense or logic never comes to mind. Innocence is lost and guilt will fade in time. Turn on your TV, watch a movie and play back. Pollute your mind, you're next in line. On this Memorial Day, the hippies and the poets and the Spartans sing back at the
streets, that's why we walk. This is the season.